This is the operator. I would like to remind all parties the call is now being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Thank you. You may begin.
Okay, this is Bonnie Baratti at Jet Propulsion Lab, and I'm going to talk about the latest results, mainly over the past year since our last CHARMS telecon in August of last year, on the icy satellites, every moon really except Titan. So let me say, first of all, that we've been in inclined orbits, which are really focused on MAPS, the magnetic and fields and particles experiments, Saturn, and the ring. So we didn't really have any new data to speak of, but we've been busy at work analyzing old data. And the major things we found are Dale Cruikshank has been looking at spectra of Iapetus very carefully for the last 10 years, and he has finally detected polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, complex organic molecules, prebiotic molecules on Iapetus. And there was actually some new data. We had data on the Enceladus flybys, and Yes et al. Looked at the three gravity passes from Enceladus and confirmed that there's a subsurface liquid ocean on Enceladus. And also, there was a paper, two papers that just came out, Porco et al. And Nimmo et al. They confirmed the fact that the plumes come from the small hot regions on the tiger stripes. And also, they actually showed that almost 100 plumes connect, I think it was 98 plumes, they showed actually connected to specific hot spots, confirming that there's not only a liquid ocean, but that the frictional source of heat is minimal, if at all. And finally, there was a very interesting paper by Dan Tamayo et al. It just came out this year, where ISS, is a very clever experiment, actually saw the Phoebe ring. Okay, starting with the complex hydrocarbons in Iapetus, this was actually one of the prime goals of the mission, to look at the nature, understand the nature of dark material in the outer solar system. And Dale's been working on this for years and putting together all these spectra. It's finally come out in a peer-reviewed article in Icarus, Aromatic and Aliphatic Organic Materials on Iapetus, Analysis of Cassini-Binns Data. So this is mainly comparing the dark side of Iapetus to the bright material. And there are various absorption bands in the 3.2 and 3.4 micron region that are characteristic of these polycyclic and aromatic hydrocarbons. And these are thought to be some of the building blocks of life. They've been detected in the interstellar medium, the dust from which the solar system was formed, but they've been kind of elusive in our own solar system. So here is a graph from the paper in Icarus, and if we look at the dark material, there's a little absorption band there at about 3.4 microns. It's much, much stronger in the leading side with the dark material. So Dale and his team has identified this as a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon. So that's the first time it really has been conclusively shown to exist in some of the dark material in the outer solar system. So the second result we have here is the a measurement of the subsurface ocean on Enceladus. This was a paper, Yes et al., that appeared in Science, I think it was in April, The Gravity Field and Interior Structure of Enceladus. Now, we had a lot of previous results that suggested there was a liquid ocean underneath the surface of Enceladus, salts in the plume, the velocities from the UVIS occultation data showed that these particles were supersonic, which really could only come out from a jetting-type phenomenon rather than type of some sublimation or evaporation. Also, the hot temperatures near the melting point of water. I mean, just at the surface, it was about 200 Kelvin. So there were all factors in favor of a liquid source for the plumes. But this new piece of information from the three gravity passes of Enceladus by the radio science experiment really clinched. They looked into the interior and with models of the densities, a function of distance from the surface, and looking at the moments of inertia of Iapetus, came up with a solution that puts an ocean that goes up all the way to about 50 degrees latitude, south latitude, on the body of Enceladus. That was a major result from this past year. Okay, so here is a continuation. This just shows a graphic that was put out showing the plumes coming from cracks that come from the subsurface ocean. As you can see, it goes up about roughly halfway to the equator. It looks like it is at depths of about 30 to 40 kilometers, so it's underneath a substantial ice crust. This result, their results also suggest a differentiated body with a low-density core. So there was a paper that just came out a couple weeks ago. There were actually two papers in Astronomical Journal. The first one was Porco et al., in which she and her team has painstakingly taken all these plume observations that SOS, the Satellite Orbiter Science Team, has been arguing for, looking at the plumes from different aspects, distances. Basically, what Porco and her team have done is they've used the principles of triangulation, looking at it from different angles, and pinpointing its location on the surface. They've actually connected this to the hot spots. They all come from the Tiger Stripes. You can see this map here, the 101 plumes of Enceladus, although I think they've only actually identified sources for 98, but that's good enough. If you look at all the sources here, they all appear, except for all of them, appear on the Tiger Stripes, those fanciful names of Alexandria, Cairo, Baghdad, and Damascus. And they also tend to conglomerate around the hot spots that the SIRS instrument, the composite infrared mapping spectrometer, that actually measures the heat. They're hot spots, and also VIMS has measured a hot spot as well. These plumes seem to be coming from these vents. This also confirms that there is an ocean, a subsurface ocean on Enceladus. Otherwise, if there were, say, frictional heat, heat just coming up through the Tiger Stripes, those cracks, those cities in the Middle East names, the heat would be dispersed. There wouldn't be such discrete sources from the hot spots. So this also suggests a liquid ocean and some underneath, and some of the heat is actually the condensation as the vapor changes from liquid to solid that also releases some heat of condensation. So that's another source of heat in addition to the tidal heating that goes on. And one of the things that the paper says, the Nimmo et al. Paper, is a theoretical basis for this. One of the interesting ideas here is that the stresses that Nimmo et al. Calculated are capable of opening water-filled cracks all the way down to the sea. It's quite an amazing picture that we have there. Okay, let's see, let's move on.
Just a reminder, yes. Since I'm hearing a little typing noise online, if you want to mute your phone, you can use *6, or you can just use your phone's mute as well. Thanks.
So this was a nice little result from the imaging team. Now, the infrared Spitzer telescope, one of NASA's great telescopes, is the Verbischer et al., 2009, a few years back, is how the ring was actually detected in the thermal infrared. These are dark, dusty rings, and they emit heat. And Spitzer did take this image of it, radiating in the thermal infrared. But there was a very clever experiment. In this diagram, it just kind of shows you how large the diffuse ring is. There's the orbit of Iapetus, interior to the orbit of Phoebe, which is kind of centered in this ring. It's kind of a torus. It's the dust from this ring that comes in and hits the dark side, the low albedo, or the leading. That leading is kind of the front end of Iapetus, the front part of the moon in its orbit, which sweeps up this dust from the Phoebe ring. So this was detected about 5 years ago in the thermal infrared from the ground. But Tamayo et al., what they did, here's the last page here that shows a diagram on the left and a graph. Basically what they did, Tamayo and his team, they looked through the ring, but arranged the images so that different images would look through different path lengths of Saturn's shadow. So some of the images were looking at the ring full on. Some of them were looking through kind of a cavity that was cast by Saturn's shadow, okay? So that would be the shadow on the ring as well, so you wouldn't see as much. So these images that looked, through a little bit of the ring, I'm sorry, through a little bit of the shadow, a lot of the shadow, the full path length. That's image number C. And some of it looked through none of the shadow. If you plot the intensity of all those images versus how much of the shadow it looked through, as you look through more shadow, the intensity goes down. So this was a kind of an indirect way, but I think a very clever way of detecting that ring. There is less of the ring when you were looking through the Saturn shadow. A very clever experiment, and if you look at it, it's a fairly linear decrease as you look through less and less path length. So that's kind of neat. I think that's my last slide. My last slide of results, but I do have kind of a harbinger here of what's going to be coming in the future. Now, we are just moving from our inclined orbit back into our equatorial orbits, and we are going to start having targeted flybys of the moons again. So in 2015, in the middle of the year, there are two close flybys of Dione. One of them will be a gravity flyby. Again, that will be to determine its internal structure. That's how we found out. It was a similar gravity flyby, actually three flybys, where we were able to detect the liquid ocean on Enceladus. So we will be doing the same type of experiment on Dione and another experiment to look at the particle environment around Dione. Then in October of 2015, it's the first of three remaining Enceladus flybys. We have two in October and then one in December. So 2015 is going to be very, very active for icy moons as we move back into the equatorial orbits. So that, I think, is the end of my presentation. And do we take questions now or at the end?
I think we'll take questions now after each of the talks. Thanks very much, Dr. Barati.
Thank you.
Does anybody online have any questions? Because we have a couple that have... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please, with your name.
Somebody is still typing. Somebody could mute their phone if they're not going to be actually talking.
Yes, everybody mute your phone unless you're talking. I think there is a way to mute. Is it star 6?
It's star 6 to mute if you don't have muting capability on your phone.
Yeah.
While people are thinking of possible questions, we did have a few sent in.
Okay.
And one question is, are the geyser plumes on Enceladus predictable in terms of are we planning to drive them through perhaps at maximum outbursts?
That's a good question, and we're not at the point where we can answer that. In fact, we've been looking at whether or not they're variable, and we still don't even know that. I mean, they're kind of different, you know, results from different teams. So, no, we can't. Okay, and also we don't have that much control over the spacecraft. We have to plan the orbital tour literally years ahead. So, for example, these three flybys that I have spoken of next year, the two in October and one in December, they're already cast in stone. And one of them is going to go really close. It's daringly close. And this is our first time we're going close, and we'll actually be in the plume. So, yes, we're going to swoop down, but we can't control, you know, when we do that very much. And we don't really know. We definitely don't know in, you know, an individual plume, how much does that vary? We're looking for that, but we don't have a clear answer of that. We have found that at apoax, when the moon is furthest away from Saturn, the plumes actually are more intense as a whole. Both the VINS team and the IS team have seen that. I think the UVIS team has also looked at that. As you look at the plumes far away from Saturn, they're actually increased substantially, and that's because the tidal force is less, and the cracks kind of open up and let more of that material out. But we can't target it to be. I think there's one occultation. UVIS is able to measure the density by looking at a star, how it dims as it passes behind the plumes, and they have actually designed one of their occultations to get at what is near the maximum. So we have some control over it, but not as much as we'd like.
So I'm hearing a little frustration, perhaps, in your voice, which is a wonderful lead into the second question. Which moon would you like to send a lander to, and why? Though I suppose maybe it wouldn't necessarily be a lander. It could also possibly be a dedicated orbiter.
It would be Enceladus. I mean, of the icy moons I've spoken of, it's definitely the most interesting one. I mean, there are images that we obtained earlier in the mission that show what looks like steam actually coming out of these cracks. I might think it would just be cool to be there and watch this material. It's like sitting there in Yellowstone and waiting for Old Faithful to, you know, come up. So that would be quite amazing. But I know my colleague, Zibby Turtle, is going to talk about Titan. And I think I would defer to that moon. I think if we were going to go back to with a mission to Saturn, I think I would vote to go to Titan. Maybe we'd look at Enceladus, you know, going in on the way. But, yeah, Titan, as you'll be seeing, it's really quite amazing.
That's very generous of you. Does anybody else online have any questions?
Yeah, I had a question about the gravity flybys. I'm wondering, do you make predictions in advance as to what you think you might find, or are you gathering the data and then making?
It's a little bit of both. What you have to do is come up with a series of models of what the gravity might look like if, you know, it had a core of this size and this density. There are a lot of parameters that you have to model ahead of time, and you kind of predict what the gravity effects will be of the moon on the spacecraft. So when you actually get the data, and actually the radio science team had narrowed it down a little bit because there were two previous gravity flybys. So this third, though, added an immense amount of data. So it's a combination. You have predictions, but there are a series of models, and then you narrow those models down when you have your flyby.
Thank you.
So I think I heard a consensus that Iapetus's leading hemisphere dark stuff is from the Phoebe ring. Is there any rethinking about that equatorial ridge regarding the collection of ring material?
It's very interesting. We still don't know what caused that ridge. We think it has something to do with the rotation and slowing down, but no model is really satisfactory. I think what you're referring to, there was a theory early on in which Iapetus had a ring of its own, not the Phoebe ring, but another ring that kind of like fell into it, you know, flopped down onto it. I don't think that's been really worked out enough so that most scientists accept it. I think the Phoebe ring, it would be very hard to connect that to the ridge because the Phoebe ring is very tenuous. There's only, you know, a little bit of dust coming in. In fact, the work from the radar, some of Steve Ostro's work, the late Steve Ostro's work, showed that, you know, the material is only a yard or two deep, you know, if that, the dark material. So it's really, really tenuous, and the material is just coming in very slowly. So I don't think that particular ring could be responsible for the ridge. The ridge is still a mystery.
There have been people looking at the ring theory again in the last year or two because it's very hard to explain by any endogenic tectonic kind of process the signatures you'd expect associated with some of the processes like despinning. There should be other structures as well that just aren't there.
Yeah.
So people have actually revisited the ring hypothesis. So I think it has gained some ground in that respect. It's one that I always questioned as well, but there are people looking at it, and it may end up explaining things better than some of the endogenic methods.
Okay, that's good to know.
Does anybody else have any other questions for Dr. Baratti? I'd like to thank you very much, and we'll be moving on to the second part of our anniversary spectacular. This will be with Dr. Jeff Cuzzi talking about rings. Jeff, you ready to go?
Yes, am I? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. I'm happy to, it's amazing, actually, that we've been here for 10 wonderful years. It's really quite amazing. But I am going to really talk about more or less the last year. First slide is actually a pretty picture that I'm going to go back to later. That blue dot at the lower part of the screen is actually the Earth. It's actually seen from Cassini looking back toward the Sun and the Earth. But I'm not going to talk about the Earth. I'm going to talk about the rings. Next slide kind of gives you this picture. This is slide two with a chart that Bonnie alluded to, that we're in these inclined orbits. This plots the inclination of the of the spacecraft as a function of time, and the blue band more or less represents last year. So you can see we're on the way down. We are in pretty highly inclined orbits, which is great from rings. We don't really want to be in those equatorial orbits because then we can't see anything, even though the satellites people can look at the satellites. So that'll all happen in 2015. But for this year and for most of next year, we're still in inclined orbits. Next slide here shows sort of an overview of what I'm going to talk about. There's a number of things here. I'll try just to hit on them somewhat briefly. So I'm going to talk a little bit about spokes. I'm going to talk about this beautiful high phase image. We're going to talk about a new theoretical result. It has to do with the funny little stranded braided F-ring that's a bit of a puzzle. This business about noise is something that stellar occultation people can do to show us how the size of the particles varies with location. I'm talking about a new object at the outer edge of the A-ring, about how this D-ring ringlet is sort of oscillating around in a funny way. And then a couple of other things. At the end here, I'm going to talk about organic material in the rings, which is closely connected to what Bonnie said about organics on Iapetus. So probably a similar kind of material, maybe two different kinds of material. And then finally, one of the real headlines of the year, I think, or the decade, actually, even though it's a very subtle effect, has to do with a very small amount of meteorite mass that's falling on the rings. So that's what I'm sort of going to cover, so let me just jump right into it. I want to hit on the spokes, slide 4, quickly. This actually happened in 2013, but it got skipped in last year's charm. I just thought I'd mention it for those of you who may be wondering what's going on with spokes. We're not seeing them anymore because of a seasonal effect in which as the sun comes up out of the ring plane, the rings get charged, the surrounding plasma gets charged, and all the dust that makes these things visible just gets sucked right back down into the ring. But this paper actually reported on observations taken sort of in 2009 to 2011 or 2012, when the sun was low, had a low elevation, so we could say see these spokes, watch them come and go, watch them grow, and actually measure some of their periodicities, which, as you can see in the charts on the right, have sort of a strong peak, sort of at Saturn's rotation period, but when you look more closely at the structure of that peak and the bottom of those two charts, all those vertical lines are different possibilities that could be related to Saturn, and you can see, well, you know, it's not a well-defined thing. So probably there's some tie-in between Saturn's magnetic field tying onto the rings, but it's really not that well understood. But those of you who are interested in spokes, this paper by Mitchell et al. Is a very exhaustive study. Okay, next slide is also something that happened slightly out of this time period. This is a mosaic of images. It was taken in July of 2013, but it really wasn't released until, I think, this January, because it took quite a lot of time to get it all put together and worked out. But it's really gorgeous. The sun is hiding just behind Saturn, sort of at, you might say, 10 o'clock or so on the disk of Saturn, where you can see the rings are slightly brighter. A couple of interesting things here. The blue fuzzy stuff, the outer blue fuzzy band is the E-ring, which is caused by icy dust coming out of these jets on Enceladus and spreading around. The sort of narrower bluish band is the G-ring, which is also related to a small moon. The yellowish color of the main rings is due to a different effect, where most of the light there is not coming from tiny dust particles, wavelengths, and size, but actually multiple scattering from the larger ring particles, which are reddish. So we're actually seeing two or three times scattered light filtering through, and that's what determines the color. So it's just a beautiful picture. Basically, the shadow of Saturn is a cylinder coming right back at us. We're in it. Okay, so one thing I want to note on here, on the left-hand side, or what we call left onto of the rings, the very innermost little bright ringlet that you can see that's, you know, maybe a quarter of an inch off the limb is called D68. It's a little narrow ringlet in Saturn's D ring, and I'm going to talk about that a bunch of slides later in the talk. Okay, so moving along, now getting down to nitty-gritty in the microscale, these plots show sort of a noise-like property of the brightness of a star as it's visualized through the ring. So what you want to imagine is, let's say you're looking out a window, and the window is, let's say, the aperture of the occultation photometer, and there's stuff going by the window. And if you have a lot of little stuff going by the window, then you have little, you know, every now and then, the brightness that's coming through all that little stuff doesn't change very drastically. Either it's sort of gray or it's not gray. There are shades of gray, if you like. But if you have big, giant boulders passing by the window, every now and then a boulder will pass by that's so big it just fills up the whole window and light just goes off. So you can imagine if you have big boulders in your rings that are passing through past the image of the star, you'll get more up and down scatter in the brightness of the signal than if you have all small particles just flowing past uniformly. And that's what these plots show. They plot this sort of noise-like measurement on the vertical axis against the optical depth or the total transmission of the rings on the horizontal axis for different parts of the ring. So you can see that even rings that have the same optical depth, let's say in the top left panel, different parts of the Cassini division, optical depth of 0.2, here different parts of that ring have very, very different noise-like measurement. So it says their particle sizes are different. And this is a measurement you can make on very high resolution. So we can really go all the way through the rings here and map out sort of how the particle sizes are changing. This is work that's really just getting underway by Josh Caldwell and the UVIS team. It's very interesting. Okay, the next slide, slide 7, shows another exciting result. The picture and its blow up there shows an actual little object that was discovered in last year right at the very edge of the A ring. And you can read all the words later on, but the bottom line here is that it's always been thought that little objects that form near the edge of the ring could be like popped out of the ring, budded like an amoeba, and sent out into the space beyond to be migrating away, maybe eventually forming something like the F ring that's shown in the picture, the big picture at the left. Maybe even the satellite Prometheus was one of these a long time ago. So this is very exciting. The chart at the bottom with all the dots kind of shows what's called a longitude residual, which means how far the thing is in degrees away from its predicted position. So like a straight line, a sloped line there, shows every change in slope shows basically a different speed or a different distance from the planet. Right around when it was discovered in sort of 2013, there are a bunch of points that are on a horizontal line showing the motion it had at that time, but then they could track it backwards into 2012, and they found it was actually moving faster at that time, meaning it was closer to the planet. And then as they continued to follow it into 2013, it actually looks like it broke up into maybe two different objects, of which one seems like it's going even faster up toward the top there, called Object 1. Recent measurements even show you can still see that thing hauling off even faster. So it looks like this little object, part of it may have escaped outside the ring, and then we can't see it anymore, because all we're really seeing is how it disturbs the ring material, and part of it may have burrowed even further down into the ring. So it's very fascinating, and we're going to keep watching it as time goes on. Next slide actually shows an interesting dynamical result. It's a little bit complicated story, so I'll just skim over it, but the F-ring itself sits in a region that's dominated by the perturbations from these two shepherding moons, Pandora and Prometheus. And the upper slide shows all their resonances in the whole region where the F-ring is. And you can see there's many, many of them. So with all these resonances in there, little test particles tend to have their orbits sort of chaotically disturbed, and you can't really predict where they're going to be up to hundreds of kilometers away over a period of a decade or two. That's what the middle left-hand slide shows, is how objects that started only 10 meters apart over 35 years end up 200 kilometers almost apart. So that's maybe, 100 kilometers, still a long ways. So a theory has been developed for this, and the theory shows that on the upper right-hand panel, these little red points show little narrow zones of stability that exist in the middle of all this chaos. And it turns out that the F-ring core, shown by the black arrow, lies right on top of one of these zones of stability. And these zones of stability can actually collect particles, because anything that orbits anywhere else constantly gets jittered around until it ends up in one of these zones of stability. So this is an interesting result, but it's not the full story. The full story is actually a work in progress. It was presented at the Rings Workshop in Boulder. But work is happening here, and it really does look like we're going to have an explanation for why the F-ring is where it is. Okay, moving along to the next slide. Let's see, Joe, I see it looks like I'm at about 15 minutes here. Shall I take about five more? Ah, you're muted. So I'm just going to tell you what I think I'm going to do.
Take control.
What's that?
Go ahead. That's fine.
Five more? Okay. I've got one, two, three, four. Okay. I think I'm going to actually I'll talk about this slide, and then I think I'm going to skip the next one. Just kind of stay on schedule. This D68 is the ringlet that I saw, that I showed you in that beautiful blue forward scattering picture. And what this is, it shows a fit to an ellipse. So this sine wave is actually the variation from a mean orbit as a function of longitude. So it's a very nice fit that it's elliptical. But one thing that's really weird about this ring, if you look at the difference between the top plot and the bottom plot, the scatter has been reduced going to the bottom plot by assuming that this ringlet is actually drifting inwards towards Saturn at 2.5 kilometers per year almost. That's really quite fast for a ringlet in Saturn's rings. So, and looking back at some old Voyager data suggests that it was in an even a slightly different position, meaning it might be moving in and out. So this is kind of a puzzle how you can have this dusty ringlet, and it's dusty because it was bright in that blue image, that's just basically precessing like a normal elliptical ring, but also breathing in this sort of slow fashion. Real puzzle. Okay, so let's skip the next slide. It's a little bit complicated, and go to slide 11, which shows the carrots and the rusty tractor and Mars. And the point of this slide is to ask a question of why are the rings actually red? Now, if you skip ahead very quickly two slides, to slide 13, on the upper right, you'll see a picture that's color-enhanced, but it shows the rings and Enceladus. And you notice that the enhancement, you can't really enhance Enceladus to any color but white because it's pretty much pure ice. But the rings are really red. They're considerably redder than Enceladus. So why is that, is the question. So let's go back to the carrot slide. There are actually two explanations for why the rings can be red. One of them is sort of the same reason as Mars is red, good old-fashioned rust, sort of oxidized iron. And the other has to do with organic materials. Some of these carbon ring molecules shown up at the top of the slide are these things called POAS, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and they are kinds of molecules that make carrots red and tomatoes red and things like that. So they are also another possible reason that the rings could be red. So we don't really know yet what the answer to this puzzle is. But the next slide shows some work that was done by the VIMS team, in particular Gianrico Flacchioni and a cast of thousands, where he's actually taken VIMS spectra. The upper left panel shows the different fields of view of some of the different instruments, and the sort of orangey one shows the VIMS map field of view. They can scan their little pixel through there and take a spectra at every point. And then the actual ring spectra is shown on the right-hand side, and you see at the far left the typical reddish slope of the rings at visible wavelengths, and around 1 micron it's kind of flat. And then you see these big absorption bands at 1.5 and 2 and 3 microns, all caused by water ice. Way down around 3.3 microns, where you can't hardly see anything at all, the next slide, the blow-up in the middle right, shows what Gianrico's done. He's just blown up those regions and looked very, very closely at those regions and dug out these little tiny bands, much like what Dale Cruikshank has been doing, little tiny bands at about 3.25 or 3.28 and 3.52 microns, they're indicated by vertical dashed lines, where there's little tiny dips in the spectrum. And they can pull these out sort of by subtracting a smooth function through this already small signal. So you might say, this is nuts. But then, I think to me the proof of this is when they go from this little panel at the right, which shows these little tiny detections, and they map the strength of these detections as a function of radius. Now, there's no reason why, if this is noise, there's no reason why you should see anything meaningful at all in that kind of a plot. But what this plot over here with the blue and red dots shows is the strength of, you can see the blue points are varying in a very systematic way. This strength of this feature is large over at the left, which is in the C ring, and it's large sort of around 120,000 kilometers, which is in the Cassini division, and that's exactly where we know the ring particles are darker. So this suggests an explanation for that darkness in this particular kind of a organic material, which is called aliphatic, which means it's a carbon chain-like compound, as distinguished from a carbon ring-like compound, which is what's shown in these red dots. Now here, these red dots don't show this radial structure, but they do show a presence that is fairly consistent throughout the region, throughout all the rings. So that the reality of that one, I'd say, needs to be further assessed, but I think this is a very interesting result. Okay, next slide, and I think I've said to me, one of the headlines, this is something we've been waiting for a long time. Most of you may know there's this question of whether or not Saturn's rings are old as a solar system or much younger. And one of the arguments that it had to be old was that the rate at which we thought meteorite mass flux was coming into the rings was high enough that it would darken this primarily icy material too fast. If the rings were as old as the solar system, the particles would have to be much darker than they're observed to be. So we're all thinking, well, gee, maybe the rings are only, you know, 0.5 billion years old instead of 4.5 billion years old. So what this result by the Cosmic Dust Analyzer instrument, shown by the big colored dots in that lower left-hand panel, shows their detections, which they can actually measure the trajectory of these incoming particles that come into their instrument, and they can map them back outside of Saturn's sphere of influence and say what their orbits are. So the pattern of these detections, the big symbols, is a really good match for a model shown by these small dots of essentially Kuiper belt objects drifting slowly in towards Saturn on nearly circular orbits of low inclination. So this is a real surprise. This is not the population we thought we were going to see. And not only that, they measure the magnitude of the flux, and it's like an order of magnitude less than we thought we were going to see. So this all of a sudden makes a lot of sense combined with a non-detection that CDA got when they flew by Rhea a couple of years ago, which was a real puzzle. The ring The meteorite mass flux into the ring is just smaller than we thought it was, and it's due to a different population. So now that the ring mass flux is smaller than we thought it was, the rings are not required to be much younger than the solar system. They can be as old as the solar system. So that's a very interesting result, I think. I think that's it for the science. I wanted to, sort of like Bonnie did, just to remind you all, we are all involved in planning a terrific finale for the mission. I'm sure you'll hear all about this at Charm 11, so I won't say much about this unless anybody wants to ask a question. And that's it. The last two slides simply give you the references for the stuff that I talked about if you want to look it up. So that's all.
Great. Thanks very much, Jeff. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Cuzzi? While people are thinking about that, we did receive some by email. And Jeff, you're going to be asked some of the more far-reaching questions, kind of the summation. First of all, given the extraordinary success of the Cassini mission in basically everything known to humankind, is there a follow-up mission planned on the drawing board in someone's head? And considering the technology on board is now somewhat outdated, even though wonderful, and it takes at least 7 years to get to Saturn. So what's on your wish list?
Well, yeah, I think what's in NASA's plan, you know, NASA has actually gone out to the community in a couple of very big studies and got a lot of input. And what's probably next for Saturn will be a mission to one of the moons, whether Titan or Enceladus, both of which are fascinating. Titan especially, I think Zibi is going to talk about. From the standpoint of the other interesting things about the planet, I think an atmospheric probe into Saturn's atmosphere would be really fascinating. You know, we've had one into Jupiter's atmosphere. It was really a stunner in a lot of interesting ways. We're still pondering. To compare one gas giant atmosphere with another would be terrific. I don't think that's actually on NASA's planning charts right now, but there is a probe to Uranus's or Neptune's atmosphere that's on the charts. Another, from the standpoint of the rings, people have talked about a follow-up mission called the Ring Observer, which would fly in and around the rings and measure some of this dynamics more directly or measure the composition of the ring particles, but that's also not exactly on Saturn's, on NASA's horizon right now. So I'd say the moons would be next, but, you know, if we go back to Saturn, for sure we'll be looking at the rings.
Any questions out there?
Yeah, I had two questions regarding the rings and the creation of moons out of them. And I was wondering what the interactions are between the rings and whether the idea of moons generating out of them were only coming from some rings but not all of them.
Let's see. There are a couple questions in that question. There is a whole a study of the interactions between moons and rings, and they interact dynamically through their mutual gravity, and they can actually affect the motions of each other. They can change the eccentricity. They can create little kinks and waves on the edges. We've seen all these things. They can drive these spiral waves in the rings. We've seen those too. These waves create torques between the rings and the moons, so the rings move in and the moons move out. This has traditionally been a reason why we thought the rings were young, because there are some little moons that are so close to the rings that if you calculate their torques, they shouldn't really be able to stay there very long. They should be moving out pretty fast. So moons like Atlas and even Prometheus and Pandora, hard to imagine. And now that we've got this this idea of the flux kind of out of our hair, we're going to start looking at those dynamical interactions anymore. There's another theory that these small moons basically form by sort of clumps of material forming in the very outer edge of the rings where you can, essentially, the tidal forces from Saturn are smaller there, so you can actually clump up a large piece of stuff like that little moon I showed you. called Peggy. And then maybe by these torques, that thing could move out. That could become Prometheus or Pandora, or maybe they could be composed of a series of these things that moved out. There have been theories by Charnos and others that have looked at that. Some people even suggested that the big satellites like Enceladus, Mimas, Rhea were formed in that way by a really giant ring that might have existed around the planet in the very, very early days. So there's a lot of ways in which moons can come from rings, from the standpoint of rings coming from moons. Probably these little narrow rings that we see probably are formed by busting up or eroding a small moon. So there's a lot of that stuff going on.
Thank you.
So this is probably related. Back on Voyager, I learned that Pandora and Prometheus were the F-ring shepherding moons, and then we saw some at Uranus. But I've heard that the term or the mechanics of shepherding are being rethought. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's what we all thought at Voyager. Very quickly after Voyager, it was pointed out that, well, that's not quite right because the F-ring is really not in torque balance. It's actually closer to the more massive moon. And you wouldn't expect that. If the traditional style of shepherding was right, you'd expect it to sort of be in balance between the torques from the two moons on either side. So we knew there was a problem with that. More recently, when people started integrating the orbits of objects in that whole region, I mean, they're just all chaotic. That was that one plot that I showed with the orbits jumping all over the place. And there's this little guy called 2004S6. The imaging team is having trouble tracking objects that they discover because their orbits keep changing. So we know that the whole region is one where orbits are chaotic, and it really is a puzzle as to why the F-ring can actually be there at all. That's why this new theory that I have to confess, it's my theory, but working with a whole bunch of other people, but it does seem that there is a peculiar combination of resonances that involves pretty much only Prometheus and precession of anything in that region, something we call an anti-resonance. It's kind of new, and it doesn't exist anywhere else, as far as I can tell. Actually does provide like a little stable home, a refuge, if you like, for the F-ring material in the middle of all that chaos. So I think that combination of resonances, now you could call that shepherding if you like, in the sense that dynamical perturbations from a moon, in this case a single moon, are actually confining the F-ring. But I think the answer to that puzzle is now somewhat in hand.
So, Jeff, I think a natural question, given the plot that you showed earlier with all the little stable places in the F-ring vicinity for particles to live, sort of begs the question, raises the question why you don't see this little, several strands of little stable F-ring strands. And I think you're just sort of alluding to the answer to that, right? The most recent work that you've shown suggests that one of those should be favored. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is work that's not published yet.
So
Sean and I were just at this fun workshop up in Boulder where I showed a recent result. And I'm going to talk about a DPS too, but that's sort of still work in progress, but it does indicate that one of these little red candidates for stability is really the only one that is long-term stable, and that is actually the one where the F-ring is.
Maybe.
If I may take the liberty of saying so, I think that was a really cool result, and I encourage everyone to stay tuned for it. And I want to hand the floor back to Joe.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Cuzzi. I think we're going to move on. Zibby, I heard your voice earlier, I think.
Yep, I'm here.
All right. I'm going to turn it over to you then.
Okay, thank you. So I'm going to talk about Titan highlights from the last year and also a little bit about the last 10 years since this is the 10th anniversary of Cassini at in the Saturnian system, which is pretty amazing. So the second slide here just shows an overview of the mission and the different satellite encounters. So we're just starting the 11th year of Cassini in orbit around Saturn. And if you look down the 10th year column, so each of the little satellites indicates the number of flybys. So you can see in the 10th year we actually had quite a lot of Titan flybys. But as Bonnie mentioned, we didn't, because of the orientation of the orbits in this past year, we didn't have close flybys of any of the other satellites. And that changes, as you can see, in the upcoming years. So the third slide lists all the Titan flybys we had in the last year. I put together the little splash screens that we have from each of the flyby web pages, which makes quite a mosaic with such a busy year for Titan. The fourth slide, as I said, I wanted to talk a bit about how far we've come understanding Titan in 10 years of exploration. The 104th Titan flyby was just last week. And that's a lot of flybys, and it sounds like a lot of flybys. The Titanian system is very complex and challenging to observe, and this kind of long-term dedicated observations by complementary instruments has really proven essential to trying to understand Titan as a system. It's also enabled us to build up global views of Titan. For example, when Cassini first arrived, the North Pole wasn't actually illuminated of any of the satellites because of the tilt of the Saturnian system to the Sun. So we didn't actually see Titan's North Pole in visible wavelengths until later in the mission. The equinox was in 2009, so it's only in the last several years that we've really been building up coverage of the high northern latitudes at near-infrared wavelengths. The radar, of course, is not dependent on illumination of the surface by the sun, but it takes the SAR imaging is only narrow swaths. So, again, it takes a long time to build up coverage, and right now we have over 40% of the surface covered with the SAR swaths. So we're getting, a global view with that technique as well now. And we have global or near-global imaging with the Imaging Science System, ISS, the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer, as well as other radar techniques, the radiometry and the scatterometry. So we've really been able to build up a global view of Titan, which is helping immensely to try to understand how Titan works. The other thing that the longevity of the Cassini mission and the Saturnian system has allowed is observations of temporal variability. Saturn GEAR is almost 30 years long. So we've now been there for about a third of a Saturnian or Titanian year, and that has actually given us a chance to observe how things in Titan's atmosphere are changing, how the weather patterns change as we moved from late southern summer when Cassini arrived through the northern vernal equinox and now approaching, moving through northern spring. And we've also been able to observe changes in the haze distribution, the altitudes, and how the haze changes with the summer and winter hemispheres. So the next slide, the fifth slide, is actually one of the slides from the first anniversary CHARM Telecon in 2005. And I thought it was kind of interesting to go back and look at what we had seen, what we had observed, and what we understood at that time. So we'd seen the detached haze, for example, which is shown in that the image at the upper left, was actually significantly higher than the detached haze as observed by Voyager, which was a surprise. And Cassini had really illustrated the complexity of the haze structure. And we'd also seen some weather in south polar storms at that point. The next slide I kind of annotated with some of the changes or what we now know 10 years after Cassini got to Saturn and Titan. So in terms of the detached haze, which, as I said, we were surprised because it was higher when Cassini got there, around equinox, which was close to the time in the Saturnian year when Voyager flew by Titan and observed it. Around that time, the detached haze dropped in altitude. And we can see that because we have observations of the haze over several years. We can actually watch the altitude, and it stayed nice and steady and then dropped right around equinox. So that's really helping us understand the processes, putting constraints on the processes in the haze formation. Also, we've observed the weather to change. The storms at the high southern latitudes abated. We have since seen one very large storm at lower latitudes. But even though we're approaching northern summer, we haven't seen storms pick up yet at northern latitudes, which we're anxious to see. On the seventh slide, this is some of the surface observations we had. Again, this is a slide from the first anniversary CHARM telecon. And we had already seen at varying resolutions many of these images. The map at the top, for example, is from the Imaging Science Subsystem observing in the near infrared. But there's some radar images as well on this. So we'd seen a very intricate surface, patterns that clearly are interacting with each other. We'd seen evidence that it's a fairly young surface. There are very few impact craters. We'd seen evidence of Aeolian patterns on the surface and of possible channels, but we hadn't at that time detected surface liquids, which had been predicted. And if you go to the eighth slide, again, I've annotated this with some of the updates from the ensuing 9 years. We didn't actually confirm liquids on the surface until July 2006, and that's because that was the first time the radar actually got to observe the high latitudes of Titan. And that's what revealed that, well, that's where the liquids are hiding, and the radar technique unambiguously can detect the liquids. So we'd seen dark material at the high latitudes, but hadn't been able to confirm until then that it was liquid. And since then have had observations with VIMS also that have been able to spectrally detect the liquid, the nature of the liquid, methane and ethane. We still only have a handful of named impact structures. There are eight that have been officially named. These range in size from 40 to 400 kilometers. There are, you know, about 50 candidates for impact structures that are circular features, but as on Earth, it's very difficult to definitively identify impact structures, and of course we don't have because of the erosion that is going on, the youth of the surface. But we don't, for Titan, have the luxury of going out in the field to identify these as impact structures. So there are strong candidates, but they have not all been able to be definitively identified as impact structures. Also, we have observations now really illustrating the expanses of dunes at Titan's low latitudes, which or something that hadn't actually been expected before Cassini got to Titan to make observations. But now we know that the equatorial regions are vast deserts of dunes, and the high northern or the high latitudes, but especially the northern latitudes, are where the liquids are present on the surface. There's also much stronger evidence now for tectonic and even a good candidate for a cryovolcanic feature that have been identified. But as I've said, the surface is strongly eroded, modified by both erosional and depositional processes, and that, as on Earth, makes it much more challenging and interesting to try to tease out the underlying structural geology. So on to what we've discovered in the past year. The ninth slide is an observation by Sears, where they were able to spectrally identify, this is the composite infrared spectrometer, and this makes observations in the thermal infrared part of the spectra, so longer wavelengths than VIMS, which goes out to 5 microns. And in this part of the spectrum of Titan stratosphere, they were able to identify the compound propene, and this is actually a chemical that's in the plastic that we're all very familiar with is polypropylene, or recycling code number 5. This is a key part of the hydrocarbon, the organic cycle in Titan's atmosphere, and we've seen the chemicals on either side, chemicals that would form this and then chemicals that would be formed from it, but this one had not been able to be identified. So this was kind of a missing link in the chemical chain in Titan's complex atmospheric chemistry. The 10th slide shows a view of Titan's North Pole. In the last year, or last summer, really, and last fall, a combination of characteristics of Titan flybys and Titan itself allowed us to get the best views we've had of the North Pole in the near infrared. This is in part because we had inclined, because Cassini, as we discussed, was in an inclined orbit, and so it would approach or recede from Titan at high latitudes, and so we'd be able to just stare down at the high latitudes as we approach or recede. Also, the northern latitudes are now illuminated since we're past the vernal equinox. And although, as I alluded to, we've been expecting summer storms to start at high northern latitudes, they hadn't yet. And so that meant that we had great sunny, clear days on a series of flybys last year that really just revealed the details of the northern latitudes gloriously. So this is a false color image combined from three wavelengths that VIM sees, ranging from 1 to 5 microns of the high northern latitudes, and there's an outline around the different lakes. The darkest features are the lakes and the seas. And those are primarily liquid methane and ethane. And the areas that appear orange in this color combination have been interpreted to be evaporite deposits. So they're effectively an organic equivalent, potentially, of salt flats on Earth, areas around lakes or areas that have dry lake, that look like dry lakes, and where material may have evaporated from the liquids evaporating. We haven't yet detected significant changes in the lakes at high northern latitudes, and that, of course, would be, you know, kind of a smoking gun if you could see that there was a lake early on and then there wasn't a lake, but there was the evaporitic material. But we haven't seen that yet, and fortunately we have a few opportunities here, especially with, as I mentioned, the longevity of the mission, to go back and look for changes. And as we discussed, at the end of the mission, Cassini again goes into these high inclination orbits, and there are some spectacular opportunities again at that point to look at Titan's high northern latitudes. And so we've got a great data set now to compare to hopefully a few years from now when we'll have similar views. The 11th slide shows observations from the camera. So these are also in the near-infrared, but a little shorter wavelength at 938 nanometers. These are some of the same views of the high northern latitudes. In these views, there's a black cross rip, which illustrates where the North Pole is, just next to Punga Mare, one of Titan's large seas, actually the smallest of Titan's large seas. And one of the things that's, we got these great views of the seas and the lake district. One of the things that's very interesting that jumped out in the ISS images, we don't see those smaller, bright, orangey deposits that that VIMS detects with the spectral sensitivity they have. But at 938 nanometers, the whole northern surface is bright. And that was particularly interesting because we don't know why the lakes are necessarily so concentrated at the North Pole, why they're at the North Pole and not at the South Pole, and what even the formation mechanism is not well understood. And so if there's a specific or a distinct surface that is related to the distribution of lakes, then that may explain why the lakes are able to form here preferentially. One of the best theories for the formation of the lakes is actually karst terrain, and that's a dissolution. We see that a lot on Earth, places like Florida, for example, where the limestone is eroded dissolved by water in the case of the Earth running through it. On Titan, we may have a similar process, but with hydrocarbon materials being eroded by methane or ethane. And so, if there's a specific unit that correlates with the lakes, that might explain why the lakes form here. If there's a unit that is erodible in this manner and other parts of the surface are not. So this is one of the big questions that still remains about Titan is the distribution of the lakes, the formation process of the lakes. But these data have really helped us to constrain some of the formation theories. The 12th slide is another view of the North Pole, this time from the radar, which has built up over the Cassini mission now almost a complete map of the high northern latitudes. There are a few little gaps remaining, but it's really quite well filled in, and you can see on the left where I've zoomed in on part of this, the northern part of Kraken Mare and Ligia Mare, just the incredible level of detail and how intricate the shorelines are, and that helps also try to understand the formation mechanisms of the seas, which are very different. The shorelines of the seas are much more intricate. They look like drowned shorelines, the way you see in places on Earth, Lake Powell, for example, where it looks like the liquid level has risen. So again, over the time scale of the mission, the observations we've made of Titan's North Pole, we haven't seen changes yet, we haven't seen large-scale changes, but we are compiling a data set in which to look for them. The radar team put together a flyover movie of the high northern latitudes, and I just provided those links in the 13th slide here and to that map as well. The next slide goes to the South Pole. As winter is progressing there, we're actually seeing how the haze and the atmosphere changes as the temperatures cool down. And a couple of years after equinox in 2011 to 2012, all of a sudden this cloud started to form. This cloud's at about 300 kilometers altitude, and we've been able to observe that after it formed and how it's evolved over the last few years. It's still there. As of the last observations this year that saw this region, you can tell that it's at relatively high altitude because you can see in this image the terminator running across the atmosphere, but that cloud is illuminated above that. So we know it's at relatively high latitude, and this is telling us about how the haze processes, the chemical processes in the atmosphere that form the haze, as well as the high-altitude atmospheric processes change with Titan seasons. And then the 15th slide, there were also some new results this year combining Cassini gravity and topography data of Titan, which put strong constraints on the ice shell and an interior ocean. The best models that match the gravity and topography data for Titan are consistent with an ice shell that's 50, perhaps 100 kilometers thick, and a dense ocean beneath that. And the best way to make that ocean dense is to have it be salty, like the very salty seas on Earth. It's that level of density coming out of the matches to the gravity models. These models also demonstrate that there seem to be topographic variations across the surface of Titan, and those can be due to tectonic structures, but also to variations in the freezing at the base of the shell. One of the things that comes out of this model is that the ice shell has to be relatively cold, so there's not a long-term convection of ice in the shell. It's actually conductive. And that means that any methane that is outgassing from Titan's interior has to be focused in local areas. It can't be coming up through, you know, if the shell is convective, there would be lots of areas where you could potentially return or supply methane to Titan's atmosphere. But the structure of the ice shell suggested by these models indicates that that's not the case. This, too, is one of the really long-standing questions of Titan. That's the Titanian atmosphere is relatively short-lived in terms of the age of the solar system. On the timescale of tens of millions of years, the methane in the atmosphere is broken down by UV light at the top of the atmosphere. This is what leads to Titan's rich organic chemistry in the atmosphere and on the surface, but it also depletes the atmosphere of methane. So one of the big questions is where the methane comes from. Is it resupplied, or are we actually looking at Titan at a very special time in its history? These kind of constraints on the ice shell and how you can get methane from the interior to the surface are really fundamental to understanding the long-term history of Titan. On the 16th slide are some observations from just last month, a few weeks ago. As I mentioned, we'd watched, we'd seen clouds at high southern latitudes in late southern summer. And then as the season changed, we saw some very large storm, or a very large storm, at lower latitudes. But that was in 2010. And really since then, there haven't been many clouds at all. In the last year or two, we've really observed, maybe two or three clouds. And that's really quite interesting as well, because most of the Titan circulation models, the atmospheric circulation models for Titan's atmosphere, predict that as we move into summer, we should be getting northern clouds building up and northern summer storms. And these models predicted this years ago, that 2010, 2012, we'd start seeing clouds, and here it is 2014, and we've been waiting very anxiously. So we were excited during the flyby at the end of July to actually be able to detect some clouds over Titan. We had an observation that ran for a couple of days as Cassini receded from Titan, and it was designed to track clouds. We do this relatively often because we're sure that eventually we'll get clouds in them. But so far, in several of these, we've been rather frustrated, and we've got lots of really great views of Titan's surface as we recede from it for 2 days. So this was, particularly exciting because not only did we finally get to see clouds, but it was actually in an observation designed to track the clouds over a long time, over a two-day time period. So it was nice of Titan to cooperate like that for us. So in the upper left, you can see a map looking down on the North Pole with Lygia Mare and Kraken Mare, and the clouds are kind of pointed out there, the clouds being the brightest feature. These are methane clouds, and they look bright, especially against the dark sea of Lygia. And then on the right, you can see a time sequence of the clouds and their evolution. And I put some links here. We have a movie because we had several observations over this two-day time period. So that was particularly interesting. We're able to monitor the wind speeds, which are almost 5 meters per second. So it's up to 10 miles per hour. These are up in the troposphere of Titan, so they're probably at 20 or 30 kilometers altitude. And it was really interesting to watch how these clouds kind of coalesced and then dispersed a little bit over this time period, and by the end they kind of diffuse. So we don't know yet if this is the start of northern summer storms. We're continuing to observe Titan, and as I said, we just had another flyby last week. So we're anxiously looking to see if the clouds are continuing, if they're going to start to build up, and we'll see more and more of them, or if this is an isolated occurrence. This kind of thing puts really badly needed constraints on the atmospheric models to try to understand Titan's atmospheric circulation and how that changes with the long seasons on Titan. The next slide, 17, just lists the seasonal changes that we've observed, starting with the Voyager flybys, moving down through now, and as I said, we're anxiously awaiting to see the development of significant systems of northern clouds and the implications those have for models. The 18th slide lists some of the highlights from the 10 years at Saturn event this summer, and these are some of the Titan specific highlights over the mission. Obviously, Huygens was the first landing on a moon in the outer solar system, and revealed spectacularly revealed the surface of Titan up close and in detail. And Titan by Cassini and Huygens has just been shown to be very, very Earth-like, with a very familiar interplay of surface features and atmospheric processes, wind and dunes, rain and river channels, lakes and seas, and even tectonic, cryovolcanic, and of course impact structures. And the chemistry that has been revealed by observations of Titan's atmosphere in situ measurements by Cassini and by Huygens, and remote observations by Sears and other instruments on Cassini have really proven how complex the chemistry is on Titan, more so than even had been imagined. So there's hopefully a lot more to come. As I said, we're in the 11th year. We've got several flybys this year, and those continue, move down into the equatorial plane again, but we'll be we have a lot of really exciting opportunities coming up, and we'll be continuing to monitor Titan to understand see how the seasons change, continuing to tease out the secrets of Titan's complex systems. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Turtle, for a really interesting overview on Titan science, not just in the past year, but giving us a pretty good perspective on where we've been in the past decade. With that, I'd like to open the floor to any questions.
This is Robert Bigelow, Solar System Ambassador from Utah. Just a question on slide 15, that cutaway diagram of Titan. Looks like the interior is pretty uniform, at least the brown section there. Is that because it really is thought to be reasonably uniform, or do we just not have good idea of what the structure might be like that far deep?
No, you're right. It is thought to be relatively uniform in the interior. There's not a central, small, dense core. The models are best fit by a relatively uniform interior.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions out there?
Yeah, I actually had a question. This is Bonnie. Those clouds in Ligeia Mare up there at the north, aren't they like further north than we were expecting for the northern storm clouds? Weren't they supposed to be more in temperate regions?
So earlier, yes, the models had predicted that that after equinox, the kind of mid-latitude clouds would pick up in the, say, 50-degree latitude range. And we saw, Titan really teased us. It threw up a couple right then, and then there's been nothing since then. But as we move towards summer, we expect to see polar storm clouds the same way we saw at the South Pole early on in the Cassini mission, which was kind of late in Titan's southern summer. So we do expect polar storms to pick up. It seems maybe that Titan has just kind of skipped the mid-latitude storms, or not storms, but the mid-latitude clouds.
Okay.
There have been a number of there were a lot of mid-latitude clouds in the southern hemisphere, and those persisted also longer than the models had predicted. So
right.
And of course, this is, we don't know. Maybe this is a special year. We don't know if this is an average year on Titan, or if it's an unusual year on Titan. So we'll see what we can learn, though.
Okay. Thanks, Vivi.
Hi, and I was wondering if you were sending some more probes, what would you want them to be studying on Titan?
That's a great question, and in fact, a probe had been proposed to land in Ligia Mare and to float across it and measure its composition and observe the weather and potentially the shorelines if it drifted to the shore. But actually, personally, I think one of the biggest questions about Titan's surface is the composition of the solid material. We have actually a better understanding of the composition of the lakes and seas than we do of the composition of the solid material. So I think if it were possible to send a lander to sample the surface in some of the or the dunes, and sample that material and understand what that is, it would be fascinating. But there are multiple ways to answer that kind of question, and if you put a mission in orbit around Titan itself, you get the big picture. You get to see the surface, and you get to observe the atmosphere. Another type of mission that's been proposed that would be particularly exciting is a balloon mission, or even an airplane that would be able to fly in the atmosphere below most of the haze, so you get spectacular views of the surface, and you get to explore and sample the atmosphere. So Titan is actually offers very rich opportunities for exploration, I would be hard pressed to choose. At this point, I would take any of them. It's very exciting to get more information about Titan.
So do you think maybe sometime in the next 20 to 30 years there will be something like that happens?
I think people are very interested in finding ways to get back to Titan, yes. I know that missions will be proposed. As I said, there were a couple of Titan missions proposed last time to NASA's Discovery Round. So hopefully there will be more opportunities that allow that kind of mission to be proposed. And maybe we can even send a larger mission as well.
Great. Thanks very much.
This is Dave with another cloud question. On the clouds that you do observe, can you tell whether there's vertical development like cumulus thunderstorms? And do we have the capability to detect any lightning?
We would, to start with your second question, Cassini could potentially detect lightning if we were imaging if there were lightning on the night side and we were imaging, we'd be able to observe it visually. And there are other experiments, the plasma wave experiments would be able to, the RPWS experiment would be able to sense that as well. That being said, the atmosphere of Titan is very different from Earth's atmosphere, and methane's not a polar molecule, so it's not actually expected that it would be straightforward to generate lightning on Titan the way we can with water vapor on Earth, with water in the atmosphere on Earth. So we don't really expect there to be lightning, but it is something that we would have the potential to observe were it to exist. In terms of the altitudes of the clouds, there have been some observations that have been conducive to measuring that. The VIMS instrument is particularly good at determining the altitude of the cloud because they have more spectral sensitivity than the imaging system. So there have been some published observations from VIMS where they actually were able to see, they had a longer-term observation and were able to see that the altitude changed throughout that observation. With ISS, we're basically observing clouds at the single wavelength at 938 nanometers. But we can infer that kind of behavior from the morphology of the clouds, how it changes over time. And that's one of the reasons we do these cloud tracking observations. So, in fact, one of the very earliest observations we have of Titan showed clouds, and it showed a field of cells, and they kind of popped up and disappeared, and it looked, just like a field of convective cloud cells on Earth. So we do think that exactly that kind of behavior occurs. There are other dynamics going on as well, but we do have seen evidence of convective behavior in the clouds.
Thanks.
Okay, we're starting to run a little bit long on time, but I've got to ask Zippy. We heard back in April about from Alex Hayes on the radar team talking about looking at the lakes and radar, and he was talking about looking for waves, and I see you've got a quote on wind speeds here, and I don't recall if that's above the threshold where we'd see waves on the lakes, but do you know if we've seen any evidence for waves? We've been waiting.
Yeah, again, it's something that we've been waiting. We expect that that as the weather picks up, there'll be winds, surface winds, and that those will generate waves. And very often the observations, the seas have looked dead calm, very flat. And in fact, not only to the radar, but the VIMS instrument that's able to look through and see specular reflections has just shown that at the wavelength of the VIMS observations in the micron scale, these are very flat. So it's something we've been anxiously awaiting. The wind speeds reported here are up in the troposphere. So we aren't sensing the wind near the surface. That doesn't mean there isn't wind near the surface, but we're not sensing it. And on this flyby, we didn't have observations that would have been able to detect wind waves here. I don't think there have been definitive observations of winds ruffling the surface yet, but there have been some intriguing observations, especially by the radar team, of areas where sometimes it looks like things are slightly different in the seas than they had been. And so it's something that's taking a lot of study to tease out of the data to make sure you're not seeing an artifact, for example, and that you're actually that what you're seeing could actually be waves. So there's some hints, but there's nothing definitive yet. I should correct that. I think the VIMS instrument has seen some exceedingly small waves.
Yeah, that's true. The VIMS
team has been millimeter scale or something.
Yeah, that's true. The VIMS team has been looking at the nature of the retro reflections, those bright spots that are seen in the VIMS instrument. And yeah, I mean, just by the spread in that spot, you can tell something about the waves, and they are, I mean, like very, very small.
Yeah, Jason Barnes had presented that earlier this year.
Yeah, like, 1% slope or something like
that.
Yeah,
exactly. He said, so they're waves, but not quite at the level we'd want to surf on yet. But, we expect that to pick up as the season changes. So the fact that we're able to, make these observations at different wavelengths and at different times in Titan's year is just really helping immensely to understand how this planet works.
And do we have any last parting questions for Dr. Turtle or anyone else who spoke today? Well, if there aren't, I'd like to thank all of our speakers again for a great series of talks today. And I'd also like to thank Joe Pateski for filling in for me at the very beginning. It's much appreciated. So thank you also to everyone who called in. We're expecting to hold our next Charm Telecon at the end of October, so please stay tuned, and we'll send out notices about that then. Thanks a lot, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Thank you very much. Bye.